This is Real Dad Society. I'm Rano Bester, and welcome to episode 8. I'm joined today by Tim Watton. Tim has battled the chronic lung condition, cystic fibrosis, and diabetes for nearly 50 years. He is an award-winning author, blogger, podcaster, and public speaker, helping others to overcome their life and health challenges by sharing his physical and mental survival strategies. Tim is living in Wimbledon, England, with his wife and 12-year-old son. He believes that every day is a gift with moments worth living for. Tim, thank you for being here and welcome to the Real Dad Society.
Hey, Rhino. Thanks for inviting me.
Awesome to have you here. I'm really honored to have you on the show. And you've got an incredible story to tell. So just for those people that don't know what cystic fibrosis is, can you explain the condition to us in a nutshell?
Yeah, so cystic fibrosis, or I'll refer to it as CF, is a genetic condition. So my mum and dad both had the 40 gene. Then there's a 1 in 4 chance that any of their children could have the actual condition. It's a protein deficiency, which means that my lungs clog up with mucus. It also makes it very hard to breathe and exercise. It affects my pancreas, so I have to take many tablets to help digest food. I'm also, as a side effect, I have the type 1 diabetes. And every single day since I was born, now I'm now 48, I've had to have at least 2 hours of medication. And that consists of 40 different tablets. That's a mix of steroids, antibiotics, vitamins, and then I have nebulizers, physiotherapy, inhalers, and of course the injections for my diabetes. Now, a couple of key things about cystic fibrosis. There is no cure. It is incessant. There's never a day off. And it kills people super early. So even though I may look well to you, I am not. It's what lies beneath. The lungs are heavily infected. And as I said, people do die really early in their teens and younger. So to get to 48 is rare with this illness.
Yeah. Okay. And in one of your podcasts or on your YouTube videos, you said that the doctors didn't give you a chance to live past 7 years or 17 years old.
17, yeah, it was the prognosis when I was born in 1971.
And how did you overcome that?
Well, when you're young, you tend to be relatively immature with your thinking. So I didn't have an adult spin on my, oh, I'm going to die at 17. It was, I'm just going to keep up with my brothers, my twin brother and my elder brother and my friends. My father got me playing sport. So field hockey was our sport and I still play. And of course, I played with my brothers. And if you're defying the odds by being active, I learned to actually not benchmark against other people with my condition. I've always benchmarked both academically, work, and on the sports pitch with healthy people. And therefore, even though 17 was hovering around me, you tend not to focus on it too much. You just get stuck into the moment, whatever activity you're doing. My lungs with the medication and the exercise is really crucial. It just kept me healthier than I ought to have been. And that has been part of the secret formula throughout my life.
Okay. And you mentioned now, when you explained to us what cystic fibrosis is, you need about 2 hours of treatment daily. So when you are traveling and stuff, do you have a physio that travels with you, or how do you work around that?
No, I do it all on my own.
Okay.
Yeah, there's tricks you learn. There's new devices that means I don't need to physically do the percussion on my chest.
Yeah.
I used to for most of my life, but work travel and social holiday travel, you know, the first thing I pack is all my meds.
Yeah.
Because once you're in a different country, you've screwed really, and you can't get the meds you need. So that makes sense. It's a lot to plan.
And actually for the listeners, I saw a video of you on YouTube where you showed how your daily medication intakes look like. How do you keep track of all of that medicine?
Well, you know, every day, Rhino, you brush your teeth. And you probably, no one needs to tell you what to do with that. It's just default mode, isn't it? And I just have learned some fantastic habits, learned quicker than most people would learn habits. An example would be there are drawers around the house that different medications need to be because they need to be in front of me. So as I go downstairs in the morning, I'm making myself a cup of green tea, but at the same time, my blood testing kit for my diabetes is right there.
Okay.
Therefore, it's a reminder. Likewise, my bag for work is packed with all my tablets and my insulin. It's just there. It's available. And there's triggers. I eat a meal. I need to check my bloods. And then throughout the meal, I have my tablets and then do my injection. Okay. It's just a routine and one that I don't know anything different. The key thing to be aware of is if you were born with a condition that's always required you to have medication, you don't remember the good old days when you just live carefree because they never existed. This is all I've ever known for 48 years, every single day, even my wedding day, you know, birthdays, Christmas day, I have to do this routine. Or I set myself out that I will do that routine because this condition is so severe that I have health that you would despise even when I get it all right. So I'm not going to let up and have less or worse health than I could do. So I'm very committed to doing the meds.
Okay. And you mentioned also that mindfulness helped you a lot to deal with your condition. What kind of mindfulness techniques do you practice and when did you start to use these techniques?
Okay, so I've not always had diabetes as a side effect.
Okay.
10 years ago, it was a likely side effect when your pancreas becomes more affected by the condition of cystic fibrosis. So when I got that diagnosis, I suddenly was very conscious, incompetent about understanding a new pretty severe condition. And it did cause me to have a lot more negative thoughts. How am I going to deal with this? You know, is this too much in my life to have two big conditions? So I was at a bit of a crossroads in my life. And just sharing and offloading to friends, they guided me to one book. And that book was The Secret by Rhonda Byrne. And it's all about, you know, putting out there what you want and the universal law of attraction. Now, if I'm saying to myself, I don't want cystic fibrosis, I don't want diabetes, I can't handle it, then that's the day I'm going to have. I can't handle it. If I'm going to tell myself, as soon as those negative thoughts come in, I spin them back with something very positive about I'm going to have a great day and it won't stop me doing anything I'm going to do, whether it be playing sport or being at work or with my family, then that's what I set out to the world. And that, because it worked for me and spinning the negative to positive, it just changed and altered my mindset. And I started reading more about how else could I be more mindful, be more present. And it just seemed extremely helpful to my mental health as well. Because in the past, I've suffered. In the future, I am going to suffer. But right now, actually, I don't suffer. And one gets far too caught up with anxiety about the future and concern about how the past has gone. But actually, the more you can join the dots of being present throughout the day, the healthier I feel.
Yeah. And what techniques do you use? Meditation? What's your daily routine?
Yeah, so I think a lot of people, it feels quite daunting, you know. Yeah. I need a whole hour to do meditation. Where do I begin? Well, I think decent habits is start small and just build organically. And I would say to anyone, start with a 1 minute breathing exercise because 1 minute is proven to be beneficial. And try and do it every day. It's like fixing your roof while the sun is shining. Don't wait for the curveball or bad day and then go, gosh, I've got to be mindful and do my breathing. Actually, think of it as a daily practice that you can put in place and then replicate every single day so that when some bad news comes along, you've actually got a template to actually be more resilient.
Yeah.
And also actually on the good moments, whether it be with my family, with my friends, you're actually more present and in the moment to enjoy them for longer. But techniques I use is the deep breathing. And actually what I've learned is everyone's got a different approach. Some people will use yoga. Some people will go swimming, you know, in the silence and within the breathing of the actual stroke. I use nature. Nature costs nothing. It's right out there. Take a seat, or just if you're out, go for a walk. Birdsong is super helpful just to switch your brain off, because that's really what you're trying to do, is stop all those thoughts kicking in, do your breathing, and just have a state of wonder about what's around you. Because that feels more impressive than all those things down the future that you aspire to achieve. Just appreciate the here and now.
Yeah.
And that's nature for me has been very helpful, because I don't have to, I just walk out the door and it's right there.
Yeah. And how long after you applied all of this mindfulness techniques did you actually start to see your mindset and the power of your thoughts shifting to the positive side?
It was pretty instant for me, because I'm good at habit forming with my meds. I'm maybe better than the average person with forming habits for something that I believe will be helpful to me.
Okay.
My holy trinity for surviving my chronic illness is three things. So it's doing that medication every single day with flawlessly.
Hmm.
It's the regular exercise. And I go to the gym if I'm not playing field hockey. And the last thing is this mental approach.
Yeah.
And if I can see that I'm feeling better physically and mentally by being more mindful, then I'm not going to just suddenly go away with it and go, I'll go back to how I was. You know, you just realize it's a great template.
Yeah.
And one thing that I want listeners to really take on board, the most important person you'll ever speak to is yourself.
That's
and
true.
You are your thoughts. And the more you realize that, and a lot of very successful people have worked this out over the centuries.
Yeah.
And it should be taught in schools, really. I think it would save a lot of mental anxiety and stress if people just got taught that. And we have to then find it via mindfulness books and in adult life. But anyway, we're here now anyway, aren't we?
And as we previously mentioned, you've got a 12-year-old son. As you said, you genetically inherited the disease from your parents. Did you carry it over to your son as well?
Yeah, good question. So one of the bizarre side effects of my cystic fibrosis is that I cannot conceive natural. I'm infertile.
Okay.
So there was never a straight path to being a parent for me.
Yeah.
And I remember chatting to my mum in my early 20s. In the West Country of England, by the sea, we're having a very sort of life conversation. And I said, I don't see myself ever having a family. And that was partly because getting to 30 with cystic fibrosis back then was unlikely. So when I got to 30 and I was then with my now current wife, and my health was relatively okay, it just felt, okay, maybe there will be a different chapter in my life. And when you get married, it's pretty natural for most couples to want to get a plus one.
Yeah.
But we knew the harsh reality was that we'd have to do IVF. And which is, for anyone listening or anyone wanting or needing to do it, because no one really wants to do it, it's a needs must, IVF is. It's really tricky emotionally. I call it the roller coaster. My book, How Have I Cheated Death, on purpose has two chapters about IVF, because there's a lot of stigma about it.
Yeah.
People don't like to admit they're having to do it or needing help. Whereas I was super upfront. I was saying to anybody who knew us, you know, we needed to do IVF, we'll tell you how we go. Because there's only a 1 in 4 chance that most IVFs will work. And then you've still got the option of normal miscarriage, which actually happened to us the first ever IVF attempt. My wife, Katie, miscarried. And it feels, to get pregnant with IVF feels like you've climbed up Mount Everest. It then felt like we'd broken our legs at the top and couldn't get down.
Mm.
You know, it was so traumatic. But then we kept going because we really were desperate to have our own child. And 5 more attempts over 3 years it took, because you have to wait a period of time in between IVF cycles, and the woman goes through it all sorts of injections and having their body mucked about with. But anyway, in 2007, our son, who's called Felix, he was born. We knew, because my wife is not a carrier of cystic fibrosis, that any son or child wasn't ever going to have the illness. But because my gene is so dominant, he is a carrier himself. So in the future, he's only 12, so no pressure on him. If he wants to have his own children down the line, then he will need to ask or check whether his partner at that point is also a carrier, and then they've got decisions to make. I never had any. Some people have ethical concerns about, well, you've brought a child into the world that's a carrier. It's like, well, he hasn't got my illness, and he runs around like a dingbat, so he's fine. You know, he is my healthy clone, and you know, I delighted that, because I've never had good health, I was able to produce a child that is healthy.
And does Felix understand your condition? Did you talk to him about that? And does he know what struggles are you facing?
Yeah, I've never really hid it away. I mean, one of the key things about CF is coughing. So he'd always hear my coughing with the lungs clogged up with mucus.
Okay.
He would see me take tablets. He used to call them daddy's sweets, you know. And he'd see me do my nebulizers, which looked really odd, but we never dodged him seeing it at all. And when he could, I think children understand more than they let on. So I was able to explain to him in very simple terms, daddy's not so well. And at times when my lungs get really poor and normal antibiotics don't work, I have to go to hospital and have intravenous drugs for 2 to 3 weeks. And so for most of his life, every year or so, I would have to depart for a while. And that was tricky, because I couldn't hide that from him, and he would know why I was going.
Okay. And how does he deal with your condition? How did he take the news? And if you're away from home, how does that affect him?
Well, I suppose his mum, my wife, has probably taken over a lot of the brunt of childcare at times when I wasn't available. Or, you know yourself, Rhino, that those early years of parenting, it's super tiring. You know, the lack of sleep. Now, that is really difficult for people like me, because it's the illness is tiring enough anyway.
Yeah.
And it's a trick. It's a steady slope down if you get it wrong with your energy levels. So Katie, my wife, took on the brunt of the childcare, getting up in the night so that I could have enough sleep to get to work and get on with life and not be knocked down too much by it. But yeah, I mean, Felix is pretty resilient. Again, going back to how I was when I learned that I would likely die early, you know, he sees me being super positive and happy and going to the gym and working. And I was his hockey coach the last 2 years. So evidence in his head is, oh, my father's keeping up with me and everyone else. It's not, oh, he's sitting on the couch waiting for death, you know? So I know he's a pretty compassionate child. I think we've brought him up to be compassionate, to be mindful of others, to be empathetic. And so clearly it affects him as far as seeing me suffer. And we do have conversations.
Yeah.
You know, the lucky lads had a chapter of my book dedicated to him. So he's always got that.
And as you mentioned now, the example that we set for our kids are so important. And that's actually, they watch us in every situation, and that's basically how they learn. What is the example that you try to lead by?
Well, I do try to be present. And so, yes, I don't think there's one parent I know that isn't on their phone too much. But when I'm with him, I do try and put the phone down. And when he was younger, I would get right to his head level and actually hear what he was thinking. And one really powerful lesson was just to say to him when he was upset, I understand why you're feeling this way. So that the child can actually appreciate that you've thought about why they might be upset or angry. Just those words. I mean, if there's a parent out there listening and they've never used those words, just go to their level and go, I understand why. It's like a magic formula. They'll just be, yeah, they'll still be a bit aggrieved, but they'll take it on the chin better than if you just do something and they've not bought into it.
Yeah.
So, and also, even though before Felix could really speak, if I had ever said to him, in half an hour, Felix, we're going to go to X, Y, and Z to see so-and-so. And then in 5 minutes, Felix, we're going to go, I think that would have been more helpful than just saying, right, we're off now.
Yeah.
And dragged him away from his toys. It's just little things like that, I think, that would, that I wish someone had told me rather than learning.
Yeah.
But I didn't really want to read a book about how to be a father, because I learned pretty quick that it's 98% instinctive.
That's very true. And obviously with your condition, what's the toughest challenge that you faced in your fatherhood journey thus far?
Well, I'm going to be very honest with you. I've lost a lot of friends, people around the world to cystic fibrosis, who died early. I've also lost quite a few who became fathers themselves. Often to more than one child, you know, because when you do IVF, as us CF people have to do, you know, it's famine or feast. You often get nothing with your IVF cycle, but often you can get twins or more.
Yeah.
You know, and then suddenly a person with chronic and health conditions has got double trouble with, you know, with twins.
Yeah.
So I sadly do know quite a few gents, friends of mine, who passed away because it was just too much for them and their health deteriorated and they couldn't claim it back. Some had lung transplants, which is our last chance saloon, and even that isn't always going to be the difference, because you can reject your transplanted organs. And so I think, to answer your question, it's the knowledge that actually it could easily be a banana skin. And there are many things I don't do around Felix that a lot of parents, fathers, wouldn't even think about. Like when he's got a cold, I don't go anywhere near him, because I've got to keep myself alive. I'm no use to him in hospital with a lung transplant or 6 foot under. So, you know, I wouldn't touch his utensils he's using. No, he's a boy, so he's like a caveman, eats with his hands, doesn't he? But you know, you know, I see other parents, they share the same ice cream with their child. Not for me. I've just had to be practical about what it is, where the risks are with getting anything that he may have.
Does that mean you couldn't kiss him as a baby, stuff like that?
No, well, I could, you know, but it would be more, you know, if I could see he had a runny nose, I wouldn't be kissing
him. Okay.
It's just picking the moments. Yeah. You know, we hug a lot, you know.
Yeah.
And you know how bad kids can have when they go to kindergarten. I don't know what you call it in Staffa, but, you know, whatever the junior schools are called, wherever you are, listeners, you know that child comes back with something like kennel cough. And it's just not good for me. And I just stayed away. And he knows, because I've explained to him why I have to be careful.
Yeah. All right. And what would you say is the number one responsibility of a dad, especially a dad?
Okay. Now, I think, well, I've only got a son.
Yeah.
And what that son needs for me, and always has done, is the physical rough and tumble.
Okay.
He wants to be thrown about a bit. That sounds awful, but you know what I mean. You know, a hard physical play. Whereas my wife will just be a bit, won't be as robust as I would be.
Yeah, more gentle.
He wants to be outside with me, you know, doing boy pursuits. He's now 12, so for the last 5-6 years, he wants to be throwing a rugby ball with me, and I take him to Harlequins. We watch rugby together. That father-son bond, where it's my rules, as far as, you know, it's, I think at times fathers can feel pushed aside early on. The wife knows best. And, oh, don't you know that they're doing this now? It was like, well, actually, no, I've been at work all week. I didn't get that memo, you know. And so actually, I would encourage most fathers to carve out time with their child, boy or girl, and find a way and little nuances that works for that relationship.
Okay.
And not just be in the shadow of the mum and wife, though, yeah. Of course, they play a key part. Felix, my son, comes to me to talk about sport. He comes to me to talk about video games, and we are immature and have a good old laugh together. No. This week, I took him to an air museum. So classic warplanes, Spitfires taking off the airfield, and it was just the most amazing day. And he loved it. The photographs I had with him, you could just see he was beaming with delight. And I had the same experience with my father. So it's replicating things that you work for you in your childhood, but then adding certain nuances that really appeal to yourself. I'd say that would be how a father can really show up with their child.
Okay. And as you mentioned now, women tend to be more gentle with kids when they're young. So kids tend to love their mom a bit more. Especially when they are young, and they form bonds with them much easier because they are 6 or 7 or 8 months with them before the dad and the dad's at work. So how did you and Katie stay on the same page regarding the parenting style early in Felix's life and actually now where he's getting into his teens?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And we didn't always stay on the same page.
Yeah.
Because IVF gives you no guarantees. And even when we had the pregnancy with the sixth attempt, you know, whether you've had a miscarriage as well, you until you have that baby in your arms, nothing is, you can't take anything for granted.
Definitely.
And so therefore, we never had that cozy chat. Oh, what sort of parent are you going to be? Oh, let's make sure we're on the same page. No, that conversation never happened because, God forbid, you know, something happened. We just wanted that child in our arms and fathom it out. Now, because we hadn't had that cozy conversation, we'd learnt the hard way about, you know, there were tricks that she was doing that I wasn't and vice versa. She, you know, you talked about the mum being closer. Well, they're genetically closer, aren't they? You know, my wife refers to Felix as her third arm. I didn't have that child inside of me, so he's my son. Genetically, he's my son, but it's not like another part of me, like...
Yeah.
Mums feel, which is why they sense their child more and vice versa, and the child will go to the mum with, you know, the serious moments and for the tears and the comfort, you know. And so what I would say, Rhino, is that we'd learnt that at times my wife needed to be a bit more disciplined. Certainly with boys need to know where the line is. Men, you know, we grow up a bit, not much. I think all women listening will go, oh, no, you've never grown up. But, you know, we know where that need to know where the line is with discipline. And if we've mucked up or been stupid, we'll take it on the chin, whether you're a young lad or an adult.
Okay.
So I knew that there are times where Felix needed to hear the word no more. And it wasn't being said. And I'd be the bad guy because I was trying to be a bit more disciplined because I felt that was what was needed.
Yeah.
So what happened was, as with most bit of disruption in a relationship, we had to meet in the middle. There were times I had to relent, and there were times where Katie had to be a bit more stern and put the discipline in.
Mm.
And actually, I think we did find a better flow after a couple of years. But yeah. Whether there's some perfect utopia where a couple can have that conversation. Hey, but once you've got that baby in your arms, then the real fun starts happening, you know, and you can't mitigate for a lot of it. It really is, you're fighting fires and there's no real manual. You're just working it out, aren't you?
Yeah, no, that's very true. So obviously taking your condition in consideration, You obviously have some important values you live your life by. What is the most important values for you?
For me, it is empathy and compassion. Okay. And having more emotional intelligence than your intellect. Mm. I think being thoughtful for others, putting yourself in their shoes, that's the first tenet of mindfulness. It's not all about me. I think that's how I live my life, and that's what I see a lot in my son. I think by about 5, all the evidence is that your child has become the person they're going to be,
yeah,
pretty much with the way they act. And, you know, one thing that I do honestly believe is the face or faces that that child sees first thing in the morning and with smiles or not is what they then give out to the rest of the world when they go to school or elsewhere. So Felix has always had love and compassion. You know, it makes me upset to think that children never get told that they're loved, and that will never happen to my son.
And how do you want to make sure that you teach your son those same values? What measures do you put in place?
Well, it's role modeling, isn't it, Rhino? Yeah. He sees it from me. He sees that out and about, I schmooze and I'm a good networker. And we've just said, you know, in a restaurant, if he goes, can you get the ketchup? I said, no, go and ask that lovely lady there. Tell her your name and say what you'd like. Mm. And he's learned to do that. And he's learned to ask for people's names, because anyone who a good communicator would know, ask for someone's name and ask them something about themselves and they won't stop talking.
Yeah.
And I'm just giving him communication lessons, because that's what I do for business. Okay. And I just think I've seen enough from him to see that he's learning and he's understanding how it works for him.
Mm. That makes sense. You mentioned previously that you are quite into sports, and actually on one of your podcast episodes, you described your condition to boxing. Can you just elaborate a bit on that, and why do you compare it to boxing?
Yes, it's a good question. Well, I like the sport of boxing. Mm. It's pretty vicious and visceral. Yeah. You know, you can't go into... There are quite a few sports you can't go into half-assed, but boxing is certainly one, UFC being another. Mm. And I can't go into my survival with cystic fibrosis in a half-assed way. Mm. I've got to be up for the... You know, each day the bell will ring. And it is a brutal illness, cystic fibrosis, despite the way I may look.
No.
I can easily go downhill with getting a cold, and which could go to pneumonia. If I stopped all my tablets in 2 weeks, I would be seriously ill in hospital. That's how quickly I'd go under. And so each day feels like a fight.
No.
And because I like sport and I like the idea that I'm competing against something, it then allows me to take personal responsibility mm-hmm. for how I will duck and dive. Not only sort of defend myself, but also be offensive with the way I punch back this illness, in the way that I take it on mentally, take it on with exercise, take it on holistically with alternative therapies. And that means that I'm in the fight and I'm not having to be knocked out. Occasionally, to use boxing parlance, I have to take a knee just to take a timeout, but I'm back up and getting going again. Mm. And it just feels raw, and it feels like I'm ready for the fight every single day.
Yeah, that's a very, very good explanation. So obviously, at what age did you introduce your son to sports? And do you think sports play a very important role in the development of children at an early age?
Yes, I mean, Felix has always been busy. He was a quick crawler and he became a quick runner. So pretty much from when he could really get on his feet and move, we've tried to get ball sports towards him.
Yeah.
I could see from my upbringing with two other brothers how important it was to play sports. I think team sport is super helpful, whether you're a boy or a girl. It actually learn a lot from it. don't always learn these lessons at school in the classroom, but actually team sport and striving and something beyond that's bigger than you is actually really helpful in life. Because I play hockey, he came to see me play in the early days when before he could hold a stick himself. And in the last 4 years, he started playing himself, and the club he went to, they needed some extra coaches. So I put my hand up, and it was really nice to be his team coach and obviously his individual coach at the same time. And as I said, we go and watch rugby together. And again, it's that father-son experience. You know, we watch, sit down and watch sport together, and he knows the players. I know the players, and that feels like a really two-way thing. I'm not forcing him to do it. He wants to watch the sport with me. And now he's suddenly got into cricket, which is great. I helped that England won the ODI World Cup. They're not doing so great in the Ashes, but never mind. And he suddenly, because it's on TV, he starts seeing the pantomime and the theatre of the sport. He's suddenly getting into it. And he does play. He plays other sports as well. And I think certainly with the computer age, where it's all too easy to stay in and play games like Fortnite, which he still does, by the way, you know, it's also a bizarre way that these young children nowadays can be sociable in the, on their own with a headset on. It's not the way that you and I, Rhino, were brought up, but it's their way of being sociable. But he still enjoys being outside with the basketball, with the rugby ball. And when we go for a walk, we always take the rugby ball with us or the football. Okay. And so we've always got that thing that's between us that is a bond.
Obviously, South Africa, England, everywhere you go, sport is very competitive these days. So you said Felix is 12 now. Do they compete in leagues? And obviously, you said you are the coach of the team as well. How do you handle the parents? Because parents are normally more competitive than the kids. And how do you find it in England? How do you guys deal with it that side?
Yeah, I think with football or soccer, I think you get probably more armchair football fans on the sideline thinking they know it all and being quite rude. With hockey, there's a bit more polite. Because I used to play hockey for England juniors, I mean, I know my stuff. You know, despite my lungs, I was able to play at a good level. And I played first team hockey till my mid-30s. So better than most people achieve, let alone someone with bad lungs. And because I still play, I've got a skin in the game, as it were, about the rules and what's going on. You do have to have the odd conversation with parents. But because I make the child feel that they're part of something, I think they then go and tell the parent, oh, I thought that was a really good session. And Tim, he made me, you know, he praised me for doing X, Y, and Z. And therefore, the parents hearing positive narrative, and therefore they're more likely to keep on my side than be demonstrative on the sideline. But it is a reality. I think other sports like football could be worse. But those competitive dads on the sideline, they often, speaking out of turn, but often they're trying to live a sporting dream through their child. Whereas I achieved a pretty good level at hockey. And therefore my son doesn't need to be amazing. I just want him to play, enjoy it, and enjoy that team ethos.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah, I actually, it's 2 weeks ago, I had a friend of mine, Johan Kluter. He's a former ICC cricket umpire. And his son is 9 years old now. And we took a good discussion into how competitive sports are. So at nine years old in South Africa, there's actually leagues and stuff going on where children are competing at rugby, cricket, hockey, all of that stuff. And he said as well, standing next to the field, and he's accustomed to international sports, how crazy some parents go. And at the end of the day, it's affecting the children because they don't enjoy it, because everyone knows it's little Jamie's dad that's going berserk next to the field. So that's actually a very interesting topic to go into, but I don't think anyone has answers, because each parent needs to take responsibility for themselves.
They do, and they've got a different point of reference. As I said, some have already had a good sporting career and can just be more quiet and unassuming on the sideline. Others, they're desperate for little Johnny to be the next great hope.
Yeah.
And so they're pushy and they're agitating. And that child could easily struggle.
Mm.
And here's what I've seen. I've seen children Felix's age, my son's age, who's 12, and all the parents are saying, you've got to win. And they don't know how to lose. And they're the worst. When they do, they don't come first or they don't win, they don't know how to deal with it. I think you've got to teach your child. It's that old adage about taking part and doing it as well as you can. Because I don't see in life it's beneficial for their mental well-being that if they don't win, they're a failure.
No, that definitely makes sense. So what has been the proudest moment in your fatherhood journey thus far?
Well, that he's born, really, because going back to that conversation with my mum in my early 20s, it just seemed so unrealistic, even to be married and then have my own child. There's a deep irony that of my three brothers, I'm the only one that had the child. I had my child first,
Okay.
And I wasn't really expected to. Just that he's there and that I've got a chance to mold and help him in his life and just be there for him. Share what I've learned about mindfulness, because when he went to secondary school, he got a bit anxious and I was already giving him some affirmations that he started using. And as I tend to help getting him off to sleep, I now do and share these affirmations. So it's a drip feed of positivity that he's hearing. And I think that will, and at times I say, Felix, if you'd learn one thing in life, it's X. And he keeps hearing these nuggets of wisdom that I've learned through hard fought struggle.
And you mentioned now that your proudest moment was the first time you held him. What was that emotion and feeling you felt when you picked him up that first time?
He got taken away because it was a very traumatic birth for my wife and for Felix. He had to have a Vontus, so they picked him up from his scalpel. He got taken to sort of the postnatal care. And it wasn't till the next day that I went to visit that I just turned up mid-morning and he was having his first proper feed. And in these little wards are full of incubators with scraps of life, and it's heartbreaking. Yeah. And actually they quite liked Felix because he was quite a robust newborn. And I think it was the ability to feed him or help feed him, even before my wife, who was on the with the other mothers in a different part of the hospital. So I think that father-son connect from the get-go was really, really meaningful to me.
Yeah, that's very nice. And now that he's a bit older and reaching his teens, what is the one daily habit or practice you feel really contributes to your success in being a dad?
I think I smile at him and get his eye contact and ask him every single day, bookend the day, how are you, Felix? And never take anything for granted that he's going to just be fine. I don't need to ask the question. Ask him how he is in the morning and ask him how his day's gone when I come back from work. And give him a hug. And I think that is a habit that he would feel odd if I suddenly stopped doing it, and I would feel odd. And it means, because with cystic fibrosis, I could easily not be around in a year's time. I want to make every single day with him count.
And the one big aha moment you had since becoming a dad?
That you don't know at all, that it is largely instinctive being a parent. I think by not going into the sort of red mist in difficult times, using the deep breath of meditation, you can actually counter maybe shouting at your child if they've really annoyed you or they're doing something that's really grating. and actually explain to them in a more mindful way, what you're doing, Felix, isn't appropriate. Maybe you should be doing X, Y, and Z, rather than going straight to the bellow and shouting, and I don't shout at him unless I really need to.
Okay.
And I think that's served me and him well.
And what advice do you have for other dads with young kids that just sometimes feel they can't get this father thing right, or the dad thing? What's the number one advice that you would give to them?
It gets better with age, and it gets better with time. I think in the first couple of years, the father will feel superfluous at times. They will feel that they're not up to scratch and they're not doing their part. It's almost, in the modern world, almost impossible to get it right. Our forefathers probably barely did much, all they were expected to do was earn the crust. Now we, in theory, have to earn the crust and still be a top dad without seeing what the child's doing throughout the day. So it's a tricky balance to get right. The father that I was in my son's first couple of years is very different to the father I am now. So it organically improves. Now, if you're worried, when you're thinking, maybe I'm not cut out for this, just stay the course, because it gets better. The child, after three, you can reason with them. Then they get to five, and then you can have little good days out. They can have good conversations with you. It just becomes easier and more enjoyable. I mean, I talked to you about taking my son this week to that, it's called Duxford in Cambridge in England.
Yeah.
It's this air museum. It was just a super special day. And we had such lovely chats and jokes and dodging the wasps and while we were trying to have our food outside. And, you know, if I thought when he was two and I was struggling and it felt like I wasn't really achieving much at times being a father, oh, I'll just give up, I would never have had that day, 10 years later. And those days when I take him to rugby games and I'm his hockey coach, and if I'd stepped away and separated, I would never have had those special moments, not the intensity that they're in. And so, yes, the advice is, it is tricky, draw breath, and just hold your course, because it does get better.
Yeah, that's very good advice. So a lot of people maybe that's listening to this and got the thing from mindfulness. Where is the easiest way to start researching about mindfulness that you can point people into, and to people that actually want to apply mindfulness and get it involved in their life?
Well, if I'm being very cheeky, I would say my own podcast, which is called The Gift of Resilience, Calm and Joy. It's unpicking ways to be more present, calmful, and the power of the mind. So you can subscribe to my own podcast. There is a super interesting book by a gentleman called Eckhart Tolle called The Power of Now. That's not bedtime reading. That is read for 15 minutes and make notes. That just allows you to transition from the sudden situation of being maybe more on autopilot to realizing what the present state and more mindfulness means. So there are two potential suggestions.
Great. And where can people actually find you? As you said, you've got a podcast named The Gift. What other platforms are you on, and where can they make contact with you?
Yeah, so my name, Tim Wotton, that's cotton with a W, my catchphrase. I was once called Wonton, the Chinese dumpling, so I needed a catchphrase. So Tim Wotton, I can be found on Facebook with that name, Twitter, and Instagram, and I have a website, timwotton.com.
All right, and looking to the future, what excites you?
Well, I don't project too far because of what I've explained to you about my health. Yeah. So every single day excites me. Okay. Every day feels a gift. It feels a bonus. And there are thousands of moments that I want to enjoy. So that's what excites me.
Awesome. Thank you, Tim, from me and the Real Dad Society. It was a very enlightening conversation with you. I think your resilience and your positive mindset is astonishing. And we want to wish you the best for the future, not only with your health, but with your family and being there and walking walking your son into when a day when he gets married. And just thank you so much for your time, and thank you for sharing your story with us.
Great. And I'm going to leave you with something. Felix, he's got his name. It originally came from a James Bond character, Felix Leiter, Sean Connery's contact in the East. But actually, the Latin for Felix is lucky, and the Greek is happy. Awesome. So, my son is happy, go lucky.
Great. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you. Real pleasure being on your show, Rhino.
Thanks, Tim.
Good man. Bye.